Court is back in session. Honorable Justice Hardesty presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning. The second oral argument on calendar for this morning is Las Vegas Sands, Inc. et al. Versus Richard and counsel. You have to assist us with the pronunciation of different parties and witnesses.
Suen.
Thank you. Et al. Case number 53163. The record should reflect that I asked the clerk to communicate with counsel the intention of the court to add 10 minutes to each party's side for argument. I assume that's been done.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Frederick?
May it please the court. David Frederick, with me is Sam Lyle and William Maupin, Lyle, Sawyer, and Collins, on behalf of Appellant Las Vegas Sands, Inc., or LVSI, and cross-respondents, LVSI, Sheldon Adelson, and William Whitener. I'd like to reserve 5 of the 25 minutes I've been given for rebuttal, and we very much appreciate the court's consideration in that regard. This appeal concerns the dramatic development and expansion of resort gaming in the Far East and the granting of gaming rights to LVSI, one of Nevada's flagship gaming enterprises, gaming rights in Macau by Edmund Ho, the chief executive of Macau, on the recommendation of the Macau Tender Commission, the governmental body that was established to review and recommend applicants for gaming rights in Macau. Richard Suen is a Hong Kong businessman who claims to have 30 years worth of experience in the import, export, manufacture, and product development businesses, but no experience in either gaming or tourism. He's recovered a Quantum Merit Award, an award for the reasonable value of his services that is now worth in excess of $65 million, premised on his claim that he delivered LVSI its gaming license in Macau. The record shows that Richard Suen did virtually nothing having anything to do with the gaming licensing process in Macau. He unquestionably didn't do the only thing he claims he should recover for at trial, and that was deliver a gaming license to LVSI. Now, a gaming license is termed a concession in Macau, and what LVSI ended up with was a sub-concession. And that came about because Jorge Oliveira, the chairman of the Macau Tender Commission, devised a sub-concession, and Edmund Ho, the chief executive of Macau, approved it long after Mr. Suen's involvement in the process had ended. Indeed, Mr. Suen does not even attempt to defend the judgment based upon his activities or the reasonable value of his services. At trial, Mr. Suen expressly and repeatedly refused compensation for the reasonable value of his services, the position on which he went to the jury below was extraordinarily straightforward. If I delivered the license, I should be paid. If I didn't deliver the license, I should get nothing. The activities, however, that he relies on are the activities of his non-party friends, principally the arrangement of meetings between LVSI's executives and representatives of the People's Republic of China, most notably the Vice Premier of China responsible for Macau and Hong Kong affairs. Yet, there is no competent evidence that even those activities had any effect on the Macau licensing process. And those activities were carried out literally by a group of friends. Those activities were never alleged in the complaint below, which simply sought quantum merit recovery for the services Richard Suen performed. And unlike the cases on which Suen relies, there's no legal or contractual relationship whatsoever between Mr. Suen and the friends.
Mr. Frederick, assume for the moment, before you get to the question of the connection between the visits with the Vice Premier, that we examine a legal question here, which I think this court must address. And that is the rule for allowing vicarious recovery in an unjust enrichment claim in the absence of some underpinning contractual or legal relationship among the participants. I had hoped that counsel would devote their time in this argument personally, I'd hoped, as to what the rule in Nevada should be and what an opinion, if it were written, would look like in addressing that legal proposition.
Let me start by noting the fact that your question characterized Mr. Suen's claim as an unjust enrichment claim. Now, without question, there are Nevada cases that refer to unjust enrichment and quantum merit in the same sentence. The jury instruction in this case talked about the requirement that Mr. Suen have performed services that were of value to LVSI. That's jury instruction 20 below. Now, that is a quantum merit framing of the question that you're referring to. And the precedents of this court talk about quantum merit as the reasonable value of the plaintiff's services. The cases that I referred to before, some of them, not all of them by any means, but some of them that Mr. Suen relies on do indeed talk about quantum merit, and they do indeed allow recovery by a party for absent persons and entities. But in every one of those cases, there is some kind of a legal relationship. And sometimes you have to dig pretty hard in the opinions to find that legal relationship. But that is the rule of law that I would suggest in response to your question. And the reason why I'm doing that is because it is that legal relationship, whatever it is, it may be contractual, it may be statutory, but there is some kind of a defined legal relationship by which, in at the front end of the process, you can decide whether a plaintiff does indeed have the authority to represent the absent parties. And at the end of the process, you can decide what the preclusive effect of the judgment that in the case is rendered. That wonderful word privity that confronts us in a variety of different circumstances, but without some form of legal privity, you have no way of telling Mr. Suen's authority to collect money for persons not before the court, or the preclusive effect at the end of the process on persons not before the court.
Mr. Frederick, again, in your brief, you described the word Mr. Suen's friends. You put friends in quotes, you know, like that. But was there any type of legal relationship whatsoever with these people, or these old politicians, or all the people he did? I mean, I believe it was about the mayor of Beijing and the vice premier of the People's Republic of China he spoke to. Who else is in this category?
Well, let's separate things at the moment. Those are the officials of China with whom Suen's friends arranged the meetings. We're talking in the friends group for which jury instructions allowed Suen to recover, Mr. Choi, Mr. Zhu, Mr. Chang, and some others. And Mr. Suen was expressly asked at trial whether there was any relationship at all, and he expressly denied it. No contractual relationship, no other relationship. This is simply a loose group of friends, was the way he described it.
Does the vicarious recovery rule for quantum merit change in the context of an unjust enrichment claim? The fact that our jurisprudence conflates, joins the two claims doesn't negate the fact that they are separate. If unjust enrichment is viewed as a separate claim, does the vicarious rule for quantum merit apply to unjust enrichment? And if so,
my answer would be no. And the reason is because unjust enrichment requires or allows for compensation for conferring a benefit. The court system would still have to figure out who that compensation belongs to, because the judgment's got to make an award. So you have the very same problem with deciding at the front end what the authority is to collect, and at the back end what the preclusive effect of a judgment would be.
And Mr. Frederick, again on that point, and I'm bringing it up now, maybe Mr. Bice could address it as well, is would any of these third parties Mr. Suen was referring to have the right to bring their own independent claims against Las Vegas Sands, and how do we tie up this bundle of people into a particular claim? Did that come out at the trial, and how was that issue dealt with?
Well, answer the second question first. This issue actually, because the complaint doesn't say anything about the friends or what the friends did, the issue was never addressed in the litigation until the plaintiff sought and ultimately obtained a jury instruction, which expressly allowed the jury to consider the services of the friends. So that's how it ended up in the litigation. The problem that you postulate is exactly the reason why you cannot create this sort of standing result that says one friend can go into court and collect money for all the friends did because the remaining friends are out there and can readily say, I'm not bound by this litigation. That's the problem. Now, as I mentioned before, you don't even get to the question of the friends' activities for Mr. Suen's activities, because on this record, none of them can be tied to LVSI's gaming rights. And the political, economic, and diplomatic importance of that lack of time.
Under the theory that there is a conference of benefit, your argument is that in the trial, the benefit to be conferred was the license?
We're now, the benefit to be conferred, that's the only benefit for which Suen claimed recovery, quite correct. Now, when these meetings with Chinese officials occurred, the vice premier of China, when he spoke of Beijing's role vis-a-vis Macau in gaming at those meetings, he said that Macau's basic law was structured so that Beijing would not interfere in the decisions of the Macau government. Yet the claim that Mr. Suen has recovered on builds one conjecture upon another conjecture upon a third conjecture that says, yes, indeed, China did influence the decision in LVSI's favor. The first conjecture is that Macau said anything, or that China said anything to Macau about the award of gaming rights. Not a shred of evidence that any such communication occurred. What Mr. Suen is trying to do, successfully did below and trying to do here, is say, well, we can infer the existence of evidence, not draw inferences from evidence. We can fill in the gap. There's no evidence that there was any such communication, but we can infer it. No. You can draw inferences from evidence. You can't use it to create non-existent evidence. Now, the second conjecture on which the first one is built says, well, this phantom communication favored LVSI from the other 22 bidders that were involved in the process. And now we get to that wonderful concept, and I certainly hope I pronounce it right, but I probably won't. Quan Chi. Quan Chi is the notion that you begin with personal relationships, you build trust on personal relationships before you move to business relationships, and that a part of those business relationships is the notion of reciprocity. If one party does favors for another party, the other party is supposed to return the favor. Now, Quan Chi might explain why something occurs. But again, this amorphous, very subjective notion of Quan Chi can't be a substitute for evidence that simply doesn't exist. And the evidence that doesn't exist here is that China said anything to the Macau governmental authorities about LVSI. And the third conjecture, which is on top of the first two, is that Edmund Ho, the chief executive of Macau, did not act in the best interests of Macau in accepting the tender commission's recognition that LVSI, then a part of a partnership application, be awarded gaming rights, that Edmund Ho instead did what China wanted. And now we get into very serious territory. NRS 47250 sub 9 establishes a statutory presumption that official duty has been regularly performed. That presumption is of exceptional importance to foreign governments as well as domestic governments, and to business enterprises, particularly enterprises in a very sensitive business, like gaming, and doing business in foreign countries, where it is an extraordinarily sensitive matter, the relationships between American business enterprises and foreign governments. Thune's brief says nothing about it. It occasionally sticks the word regularity in an argument that's otherwise addressed to legality, and the district court not only didn't apply the presumption, it didn't even instruct the jury on it. Let me move to one of the other issues. And that is
Mr. Frederick,
the so-called procurement.
Pardon me, Mr. Frederick, on that point, without that instruction, could you just very briefly tell us how the arguments went without the instruction of regularity of the officials?
What leaps to my mind is Suen's counsel's argument that the process was manipulated. Their words in closing argument.
And your response to that would be, if we had the instruction, we could have countered that.
With the instruction, the jury would have countered that, because there is absolutely no evidence, none, of any such manipulation. And that is the whole point of the three conjectures, one on top of another, that I just referred to. Now, the procurement deal came about when Mr. Suen went to Mr. Widener, the president of LVSI and the man with whom he had dealt, and said, okay, you've got your gaming rights, pay me. Mr. Widener said, pay you? We're not going to pay you. You didn't do anything. That is a dispute, despite the fact that Suen, in its briefs below and here, simply ignore that portion of the record. Once there is a dispute, then an offer of compromise and settlement is inadmissible. And that's exactly what occurred. Mr. Adelson attempted to negotiate an offer that would have resolved the claim under the earlier compensation formula with a separate compensation package. It was rejected. It never should have gone to the jury. Let me reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Frederick. Mr. Bice, good morning.
May it please the court, Todd Bice on behalf of Richard Suen and Round Square. I would reserve at most 2 minutes for my counter-appeal, if necessary. But let me address and jump right into the issues, the questions that are being posed. And I'll deal first, Justice Hardesty, with your question. You would raise the question about this issue of vicarious recovery. Let me be clear about one thing. Richard Suen is not seeking and did not seek in the district court to recover for rights that belonged to other people. He sought and recovered for claims that he had first party standing to recover. Suen conceived of this plan, he executed this plan, he carried out this plan, he organized the plan, and he's the one who enlisted all of the people that contributed to it. He is the one who had standing, and he is the only one who had standing. We know this for a fact because Sands admitted it below. Look at what the record shows in terms of what happened when one of those individuals came to Sands directly and said, I want to have a direct relationship with you and you can pay me directly. What did Sands say? That was Mr. Chang. Sands said, no. You're with Suen. We're dealing with Suen. And they even sent Suen a fax alerting him that one of his people that was standing behind him assisting him had in fact tried to do that. Well, there's even more evidence of that. Mr. Adelson's own brother, Lenny, who I will get to in just a moment, but when Lenny Adelson was going to get compensated, did Sands say, okay, well, we'll compensate you directly because you have a direct relationship with us? No. Mr. Adelson sent his own brother, Lenny, to Richard Suen, saying, you get compensated through Suen. When the procurement deal came up, to whom was the procurement deal offered? Was it offered to all these other people who they are now saying had a relationship with them and could recover? Of course not. It was offered to only one person, Richard Suen, because that is the person with whom they dealt. That is the person who did the work, who organized it, directed it, did everything. And my point here is quantum merit is, of course, as this court has used the word, is an implied contractual claim. It's a claim that is asserted when the court says, for whatever reason, there isn't an express contract in existence. Well, who did they have the implied contract with? They had it with only one person, Richard Suen, and by their own conduct admitted that repeatedly. You cannot seriously contend that the chairman of the board of Las Vegas Sands sent his own brother to Richard Suen if they thought that the company was the one that owed Lenny money. So my point here is, and Justice Hardesty, this comes back to the question you had raised, and that is, and Mr. Fredericks was arguing, well, what sort of legal relationship? He said there was none. I dispute that. Suen didn't have a contract, according to the district court, didn't have a contractual relationship with Sands. But did he have a legal relationship? Of course he had a legal relationship with Sands. He was allowed to proceed on his quantum merit claim. Does Suen have a legal relationship as opposed to a contractual relationship with these other people that assisted him? By all means, yes. He, in fact, testified that he had promised Lenny Adelson, Mr. Adelson's brother, 20% of whatever he, Suen, had recovered. Mr. Choi also testified at the trial, and Mr. Choi testified, I don't have any claim against Sands directly. I'm getting compensated through Suen. There is not one witness in this case, not one, who testified that they had a direct claim against Sands other than Suen. Everyone else acknowledged, and Sands acknowledged it itself, that their relationship was with Suen, the compensation would go to Suen, and it would be up to Suen, whatever relationship Suen had with other people, to compensate them. Apply this common sense approach to just typical broker cases that this court sees with some frequency. Brokers have deals. They put a deal together. They have assistants that help them. They have friends that help them. They have acquaintances that help them. They may even give them the lead. They may introduce them to the seller, help facilitate that. Can the buyer, can the seller of the property come in and say, well, Mr. Broker, you can't recover for the fact that you used other people to assist you in providing the ultimate service that we sought from you, benefited from you, and claimed. The answer to that has to be no. Because in this particular relation, in this particular case, they dealt with Suen, they acknowledged it, and they, in fact, sought to compensate him. Just look at the subcontractor cases as well. A subcontractor can recover, or the general can recover for the subcontractors. Yes, they have a legal relationship. They may not have an express contractual relationship, but there's still a relationship there, and there may be a legal obligation to pay. And this court has always allowed the general to recover for people that are standing behind them. There is no difference here for Mr. Suen. Yes, he had people standing behind him. He had colleagues standing behind him. He referred to them as his friends, as a loose group of friends, to provide assistance. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have a legal relationship with them, that they would be entitled to compensation from him if he recovers, and he has acknowledged that he is obligated to pay them, just like he did acknowledge with respect to Lenny Adelson himself. They would propose to expand quantum merit beyond its any conceivable bounds, because according to Sands, we now allow only quantum merit for your physical acts. If you physically do something, then you can recover. But now we're going to have multiple plaintiffs in every claim because every person who physically did something now has to be joined in the lawsuit as a necessary party. The broker's assistant, if the broker recovers in quantum merit, does he have a legal relationship with his assistant? Sure. But does the assistant now have to be a named party in the case in order to recover for the entirety of the effort?
Doesn't the court's analysis of that examine the relationship that exists between the claimant and their associates, and in making that determination, finds that the person appropriately represents this group or has a contractual relationship. In the subcontractor cases, it's clear you have a connection between the contractor and the subcontractor. In the Morrow case, the broker case, there was a husband and wife involved where the community property interest relationship existed.
I apologize, Your Honor, I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's okay. I guess I'm trying to clarify, and I return to this question once again. Your client's claim, as I understood it, was unjust enrichment.
My client's claim was quantum merit.
Okay.
That was the claim asserted. That was the claim that was tried.
Reasonable value of services rendered.
Reasonable value of services rendered, and as this court has repeatedly held, the value that the parties themselves placed upon that, the value of those services rendered, the jury is entitled to consider it. And here we know that the value that the parties placed upon it. The Sands placed about $100 million upon it in the terms of the procurement offer, in the terms of the $5 million 2% that they'd offered at the time of trial, that was deemed to be $92 million. And I apologize, the procurement deal was deemed by the experts to be worth $86 million at the time of trial.
Okay. Mr. Frederick argues to this court a few minutes ago that in the context of a quantum merit claim,
yes,
the law requires for vicarious recovery the existence of a contractual or similar legal relationship between the parties. What was the legal relationship between your client and those who assisted in the arrangement of the meeting with the Vice Premier?
The legal relationship between my client and those people is the same as the legal relationship that my client had with Las Vegas Sands, and that is he solicited them to assist him, and they expected to get compensated from Suen for that services that they rendered to him. That legal relationship is the same no matter how far down the chain you go. That the fact, Mr. Frederick doesn't cite any case law that actually says you have to have a contractual relationship, an express contractual relationship. You can have a legal relationship, such as a relationship that's an implied contractual relationship, which is what quantum merit really is. These people would meet the test, presumably, of having a quantum merit claim against Suen if, in the event, he didn't somehow honor his obligations. But he actually intends to honor his obligations, unlike Sands. He will honor his obligations. And the point here is, if he doesn't, they will obviously, whatever law governs their dispute, they will have to deal with it. But that isn't, I would respectfully, Justice Harsey, I don't believe that's relevant to this court's analysis of this, to say, well, we aren't sure that a plaintiff is necessarily going to honor their legal relationships, whether they're contractual, whether they're in equity, whether they're implied in law, they're implied in fact, whatever. We're concerned that he won't honor them and that somehow should diminish his recovery. That's like saying that a plaintiff in a personal injury case might not pay all their taxes on the recovery, and that should somehow be a consideration in whether or not they should recover. I understand I'm being a bit facetious about that, but that's the point I'm making.
Well, I think Rule 17 requires more than that.
Requires more than that they have a legal relationship with each other?
Yes, indeed.
I don't believe that
the rule says that.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but here there is no one. Las Vegas Sands itself, Rule 17 concerns itself with parties that are necessary parties to the proceeding. This, and again, there's no accident that this wasn't raised until appeal. There was no Rule 17 issue raised before the district court below. It's raised in the first time on appeal for one reason and one reason only. It's an afterthought. It's an afterthought that's being raised now because the jury verdict went bad. The reality here is there is not a single person, not a single witness, not a single lick of evidence in this record that anyone else has made any claim against Sands that's in behind Suen in the chain or have suggested that they have a claim. They all recognize, just as Sands itself recognized, they all get compensated, if at all, through Suen because that's the relationship they structured and included Mr. Adelson's own brother. Now let me turn, if I might, unless there are further questions on that, to, I hope, Justice Gibbons, I've answered your question. We dispute under this record that there is no legal relationship. Yes, Mr. Suen, as an individual, as a layperson, characterized it as a loose group of friends. That is true. But loose group of friends doesn't mean that it's not a legal relationship. That happens every day. And just like in Morrow, and what I was going to say to Justice Hardesty on this, Morrow doesn't actually turn, and the court doesn't even address, to my recollection, any claim about community property assets. I understand that demonstrates that there would be a legal relationship behind it, but there's no indication that that somehow the case turned or that that was a prerequisite for their for the woman's recovery. But I would like to also now turn, if I can, quickly to this issue about there's no evidence here. This is all speculation. With all due respect to the Sands, it's belittlement of the jury and the district court in comparing, saying that for 29 days, the jury watched a rain dance and therefore concluded that since it rained, it must have been the rain dance that caused it, is beyond the pale in terms of this record. Seldom do you have evidence in a record like you have in this one where the chairman of the board, immediately after getting the license, calls his own brother and starts to talk to him about his compensation, the very brother who had brought Sue into the table. And then within a month of that phone conversation, tells his own brother, by the way, recall this fact, he had told his brother before the license issued that this would be the brass ring of the merry-go-round, Lenny. You'll have more money than you can possibly spend if we get that license. Fast forward to after they get the license. He tells his own brother, let's sit down and talk about your compensation. They sit down and chat about the compensation, and what does he tell his own brother? You get paid through Suen. Go talk to Suen about your compensation. There is not another case I can recall of where you have a direct admission from the chairman of the company about causation and liability like you have here. But there's much more than that here. Mr. Frederick said, well, there's absolutely no evidence in this record anywhere that there was any communications about what was going on in Beijing with the representatives in Macau. Well, is that right? Well, I happen to recall Suen's testimony where he said that he met with Widener after Sands was in trouble. They had joined with this Taiwanese bank, which was completely naive of them to think that that somehow wasn't going to be an issue. They joined with this Taiwanese bank, and they were salvaged by Edmund Ho. They were saved by the creation of this separate, you know, new process, this new matching, and then subsequently an entirely new concept called a subconcession. It was during those conversations when Ho was trying to save them that Widener told Suen that Ho had raised with him his knowledge about the Beijing meetings. Now, interestingly, those meetings are somehow so irrelevant to what happened, but yet they come up in the very critical moment in which they're being saved by Edmund Ho.
Were those statements hearsay and how they were presented?
Well, they were certainly not objected to at trial if they were hearsay, but the answer to that would be no, because it went to the knowledge of Bill Widener, Your Honor. And our point here is to sit there and say that there's no evidence in this record, when you have the chairman of the board admitting it to his own brother, I think is a stretch beyond stretches. If I were standing here in front of this court on another case and I told you that that's not evidence, you would all probably scoff at me and would rightly scoff at me because it's unquestionably hard evidence. So this is not some case built upon speculation, conjecture, and otherwise. This is evidence that the jury heard for 29 days of evidence from witnesses, all of whom ended up largely confirming the same story. Look at what, again, the sort of chronology that happened. Suen brings this concept to them. Asia wasn't even a twinkle in the Sands' eye until they met Richard Suen. Suen brings the mega, he insists you pursue the mega resort concept. Sands said, well, we didn't want to do that because they had apparently secretly met with Edmund Ho without Suen's knowledge, and he had discouraged them from doing that. They didn't want to do that. Fast forward to what happens. Suen arranges these incredible meetings, what Sands described as incredible meetings, with the vice premier in China, who invites them to bid and who affirmatively says, we can send as many people as you can build hotel rooms for. Then they meet with the mayor. They create the relationship with the mayor, giving the impression that they had quashed the Olympic bid. And then look what happens. Subsequently, they meet with Edmund Ho again, and the guy's view has changed 180 degrees. Before, he was Mr., we're only going to have small gambling joints in Macau like we've had the last 50 years under Portuguese rule. To now, after those meetings, Edmund Ho is telling the Sands, yes, we want the mega resort concept. That's what we're going to pursue now in Macau. And again, when he's saving Las Vegas Sands is when he even acknowledges to Widener his awareness of those meetings. And then I get, come back to, again, most tellingly, seldom do you have in cases evidence of this nature where the chairman of the board himself admits it. Ladies and gentlemen, or members of this court, you hear cases all the time. The juries in this state hear cases daily involving discrimination, negligence, wrongful termination, where they have to decide, based upon the evidence, what is more likely than not happening. And that is all that the jury here had to do. It heard direct testimony from multiple witnesses about what happened. And yes, some of them, I'm sure they had to draw some inferences, but that does not mean that that this result is based upon speculation, conjecture, or the other adjectives used by Sands to try and belittle the jury's result. Now turning to Mr. Fredericks has argued this point about, well, if they were successful in getting a license, then it could have only been through some unlawful means. And just sorry to see, this comes back to a question you would ask, well, what was the benefit that was being sought? The benefit that was being sought, obviously, was the license. But this is a governmental process. And as Adelson's own letter to Suen confirmed, there was no expectation that Richard Suen was going to walk across the street and grab a license from someone. That's not how the process worked. What they had asked Suen to do, and what he did, and what they touted, and what they claimed great benefit from, is he introduced them to the right kind of people in China. He introduced them to China to begin with, period. And the right type of people that could assist them in helping them structure their strategy, figuring out what they wanted to do, and who would be in a position, if at the end of the day necessary, to bestow goodwill upon the Sands. That's what they asked him to do, and by the way, that's exactly what he did. And it's not an accident that that's what he did, and it's not an accident that right after he did it, and right after Sheldon Adelson talked to his own brother about compensation, within a matter of about 6 weeks, they sent the procurement deal on to Suen, which they claimed would compensate him $100 million. Because who would know better what Richard Suen did for Las Vegas Sands than Las Vegas Sands itself? That doesn't require speculation or guesswork. The people that know knew, and that's why they said, we'll pay you $100 million, but we need to structure it differently because we don't want to draw the ire of the Nevada gaming regulators or of the federal government. And so let me deal with this issue about the procurement. Mr. Frederick says, oh, there was a clear dispute. Not so. What Suen testified was is that he met with Widener to talk about payment, and Widener said, no, you didn't do anything. We're not going to pay you. This is the same individual who in his deposition had testified, yeah, he had done a lot, and that's why we were trying to get money to him. But fast forward that just slightly, because during that same conversation, what Widener says is, but I'm not the one who brought you in here. Adelson is. So you'll have to go talk to Adelson about payment. He goes and he talks to Mr. Adelson about payment, and what does Mr. Adelson say? Does he say, no, we're not going to pay you, you didn't do anything? No, Adelson acknowledges, according to Suen's testimony, which we have to presume to be true, Adelson acknowledges that they were indebted to him and that they were obligated to pay. Hence, the procurement deal comes up from Adelson. Their position is truly absurd. They're saying that if someone who is not the decision maker says that there's a dispute, then even though the decision maker himself, Adelson, doesn't think that there's a dispute, doesn't claim that there's a dispute, then every communication that happens thereafter is now a settlement negotiation. Members of the court, business in this state would come to a standstill if that were true. If everybody in the lower chain of command somehow could claim, well, I disputed whether or not there was a liability or a payment, so now I shouldn't, so if the higher-ups end up paying you or offering you something, that's necessarily a settlement agreement?
You consider Widener in the lower chain of command? Do you consider Bill Widener in the lower chain of command of Las Vegas Sands?
Absolutely he is. Below the chairman of the board, Sheldon Adelson? Absolutely he is. In terms of this structure here and what Widener himself directed Suen to go to Adelson regarding payment, yes, he's in the lower chain of command.
Mr. Bryce, what about the NRS 47.250 issue?
Yes, turning to that, this issue, again, their theory now is that they say, well, the only way Suen can recover is if something nefarious happened. Let me be crystal clear about something. No one claimed that any official duties or laws were violated here. There is a fundamental distinction about what went on with the tender commission as opposed to what went on and who granted the actual license. This issue about the manipulation that they're talking about,
That came out of George Oliveira himself, who testified that the process ended up resulting, because Edmund Ho changed it in midstream for the benefit of Las Vegas Sands, resulted in someone getting a license it wasn't entitled to. Well, guess who that was? It wasn't the Sands, it was Galaxy. They falsely claim in their brief that we argued that it was Sands that they got a license that it wasn't entitled to. Not true. Just look at the record and look at the closing argument. In fact, in the very spot they're claiming we were claiming manipulation and unlawful activity, Mr. O'Malley, who presented the closing argument, said, we do not claim that anyone violated any laws or any official duties were not followed, because Edmund Ho had the absolute discretion to issue the licenses to whomever he wanted. The tender commission was merely a process of recommendations. And there's no question that Edmund Ho did, in fact, alter the protocol in order to accommodate the Sands.
So why wasn't the jury instruction given?
The jury instruction wasn't given because it would have been misleading, Your Honor. Look at what they're trying to argue to you right now. Look at page 31 of their brief at the bottom of it. They claim the following. In order for Suen to recover in quantum merit, because the only way Suen could deliver the license, according to the Sands, is if, in fact, he did something nefarious to get them the license. Otherwise, they just get the license as a matter of because they're a good candidate. And what they wanted to use that instruction for was the wholly improper purpose of arguing to the jury that Richard Suen can't recover in quantum merit unless he can show you that this presumption is untrue, that official duties were violated, or that the law was violated. And that isn't the law. And in fact, as you'll notice in their brief, what they then turn around and say is, had Suen been successful in showing that official duty had been violated, or that the law had been violated, he can't recover at all. Because you can't recover.
It was worth $48 million?
What's that?
It was worth $48 million?
What? I apologize, just
His work for the Sands was worth $48 million.
It was worth more than that. I believe that this verdict was too low. I understand that we are not seeking any sort of editor, but this verdict is very low considering what the evidence was. Sheldon Adelson himself offered him $100 million right after he got the license. The experts testified that that dollar figure that Adelson had offered him was worth, I believe it was worth $86 million. The deal that they offered him right after the meetings in Beijing, the experts testified that that was worth $96.2 million. The jury awarded $43.8 million. Suen had originally proposed a $40 million proposal to him, so the number was actually, for the jury awarded, was a lot closer to what he had originally proposed to them than what they had in fact offered him, as the experts established. So was it worth that amount of money? Absolutely, it was worth that amount of money. And I see that I'll reserve what my 40 minutes that I have if there are no further questions from the court. For 40 seconds, 40 I apologize. Seconds. Thank you. Justice Shearing doesn't want me up here for 40 minutes. I can understand that. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Bice, thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Bice by court members yet? All right. Mr. Frederick?
Mr. Frederick, you consider Bill Widener in the lower chain of command of Las Vegas Sands?
He was the president of Las Vegas Sands, and more importantly for this, he's the one who issued the $5 million plus 2% proposal that Mr. Suen was trying to collect on. This is not a functionary in the clerk's office. This is the man with which, and we've thrown the word deal around, even though this is a quantum Merowith claim, this was the man he was dealing with. He said, no, you're not getting paid. And, oh, is it so shocking that somebody above him, in this case the CEO, then attempts to settle that claim after the dispute has arisen? Nonsense. Okay, standing, not raised below. Flat wrong. It was raised at the time the jury instruction was proposed. It was then briefed at length and in depth in the post-judgment motions. No case law, says Mr. Bice. Well, he didn't read this court's L&H Builder Supply versus Boyd Company, in which this court held, guess what? Even an assignment is not enough to allow the assignee to institute suit to collect. The assignee has to have a legal interest in the claim of the non-existent party. Let's see. Suen dealt only with LVSI. None of the friends did, etc. Look at the complaint. Is there an allegation of agency? Is there an allegation of authority to collect money for these friends' activities? Is there anything that would suggest to anybody that Suen was in fact suing for his friends, which is what the district court allowed him to recover for? No, of course not. Now, Mr. Bice says, well, there's some kind of a legal relationship here because quantum merit is an implied contractual claim. Well, the only problem is that is not the basis for any of these claims that were made in the complaint, that there was some kind of an implied contractual relationship that allows me to recover. No, these services performed by the others were never alleged, and in particular, never alleged in support of Mr. Suen's claim. Oh, let me see. Sheldon Adelson sent Lenny to Mr. Suen to be paid. Well, funny thing. It's Sheldon Adelson who attempts to negotiate a compromise of Suen's claim with a procurement deal that is now touted by Suen as going to get him $100 million. Not surprisingly, Mr. Sheldon Adelson sends Lenny off to Suen to get paid. Edward Ho's change in viewpoint, only explainable by getting some kind of a message from China. No. Look at the Macau Tender Commission's recommendations. They recommended mega resorts, Wynn resorts, at that time the Galaxy Las Vegas partnership. Ed Ho did what his official duties to Macau and Macau's interests were, not China's. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Frederick. Mr. Bice, we asked some questions there, and I don't think we want to try to keep track of 41 seconds, so why don't you take a couple of minutes.
We didn't talk about our cross-appeal. I'll only just mention it briefly. It is a conditional cross-appeal, as we have articulated in the brief. You know, we believe that the district court was in error in depriving us of our contract and fraud claims by way of summary judgment, but we only raise that issue. Only raise that issue in conjunction with if this court were to somehow conclude that this verdict couldn't stand and the matter had to be retried is the only context in which we raise that.
Well, there is a dispute in terms of how the offer over the offer of compromise or how this was used in the defense of the breach of contract claim. I would appreciate it if you would address that in
yes.
the context of your cross-appeal.
The district court, what the district court observed, and I think that the district court obviously is in the best position to know, since it was the one that granted summary judgment on our contract claim, that they had used, they claimed that what they are now calling a settlement agreement or a settlement proposal was in fact not one. They claimed that it was a compensation system for Suen. It wasn't a settlement agreement, and they used it affirmatively against us, saying that it was admissible to show that they did not have an intent to defraud Suen. And I apologize, it wasn't the contract claim, it was the fraud claim, that they affirmatively used it on. So they said that it was actually affirmative evidence that they could use that negated any evidence of intent. That can't be true if it was a settlement agreement or a settlement proposal, because it wouldn't negate any intent if it were, in fact, a settlement proposal. Settlement proposals are made on cases all the time, including fraud claims. It can't be affirmative evidence of negating your intent to not pay them if, in fact, it was purely a settlement proposal. Their counsel knew that, and that's why he argued in front of the district court that it was, a compensation system, not a settlement proposal. They were seeking to compensate Suen for everything he had done for them, which counsel emphasized to the district court judge, was a $100 million proposal. The thing I find entertaining about the procurement deal being a settlement offer, it was for $100 million. What was the compromise?
If you're seeking to offer someone $100 million, how are you trying to settle the claim? Suwin hadn't even asked for that much money. They just threw out this number because they knew the value of the services that the man brought, and they used it affirmatively to defeat the fraud claim. It was not a settlement offer. There are no further questions from the court. I thank the court.
Any questions from the members of the court?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bice, counsel. We appreciate your excellent arguments and briefs in this matter, and it will stand submitted. Court's in recess.
All rise.